Hello, this is Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman of Columbia University speaking to you today for Medscape. My comments today could be titled, Psychiatry Suffers Another Indignity, or What Does the New York Times Have Against Psychiatry? The reason I say this is because this past weekend, January 2019, in the reviews section, which has the op-ed articles in the paper, an article was published called Redefining Mental Illness. The article was written by a T.M. Lohrman, who is an anthropologist on the faculty at Stanford University. Dr. Lohrman, by her background, is a very well-educated anthropologist who has been a prolific contributor to the public media and literature for the lay public, as well as within her own academic field, and has written several books. I'll come back to these in a minute. But the article about mental illness was really an incredibly unscholarly, misinformed, confused, and at worst unhelpful, and at best, you know, kind of destructive commentary, which will add to the confusion about diagnosis of mental illness, enhance the stigma, and may lead some patients to doubt the veracity of the diagnoses that they've been told they may suffer from and the treatments that they're receiving. Specifically, Dr. Lohrman was prompted to write this by a report that came from the British Psychological Society, which is a professional organization in the United Kingdom. And this report was called Understanding Psychosis and Schizophrenia, suggested that hearing voices and feelings of paranoia were common experiences, commonly occur in the course of everyday life, particularly in the context of trauma or abusive deprivation, and that they shouldn't be called symptoms of mental illness and attached to diagnoses, because that's only one way of viewing them. And viewing them in different ways, diagnoses as normative mental phenomena, have relative advantages and disadvantages. This strikes me as preposterous. I mean, it is at best phenomenologic relativism, and at worst simply conflating symptoms with a disorder or a disease. It's common knowledge to every student of medicine and most knowledgeable lay people that just because you have a symptom doesn't mean you have an illness. You can have fever without having an infection. You can have shortness of breath without having asthma or heart disease. You can have chest pain without having a heart attack. You can have a headache without having a tumor. So no one has ever conflated a diagnosis, symptom with a diagnosis. It's a constellation of symptoms occurring in a specific pattern and conforming to an observed and potentially sort of validated condition that defines a diagnosis. There are rigorous principles which govern the process of establishing a diagnosis or refining the criteria by which it's identified. Then it goes on to say that there's no strict dividing line between mental illness and normality. And although clearly everyone knows that there is sort of a spectrum of severity that symptoms in the context of an illness occurs, there's no question that at some point it crosses a threshold by which it's defined as an illness. So viewing it this way is in a way sort of challenging the veracity of diagnoses and giving people who have symptoms that are of a mental disorder license to doubt that and to believe that they may have an illness and need treatment. It goes on to talk about the fact that there's no evidence for antipsychotic drugs correcting any biologic abnormality, which also is inaccurate. I mean, antipsychotic drugs, we know, work through the antagonism or the blocking of dopamine. They may have other downstream and upstream effects within the neural pathway, but the link between dopamine activity and psychotic symptoms is indisputable. Now, the other thing is that after making this point, which essentially is equating symptoms with illness, the article says this is consistent with a view taken by the NIMH's director, Tom Insull, in a commentary on his blog in 2013, where he expressed frustration with the traditional diagnostic categories in the DSM because they were not sufficiently heuristic in guiding scientific research. Well, that is true. You know, Dr. Insull did describe the fact that in order to inspire disruptive and transformative research, that we should not be bound by the constraints of traditional clinical diagnoses, and we should seek to cross between them and to define neurobiologic circuits, anatomy, biochemical pathways that may enable us to sort of more precisely or validly sculpt the diagnoses or redefine them altogether. But in a letter that Dr. Insull and I, as then president of the APA, jointly released in 2013, we both stated the fact that while our docs, which is the NIMH Initiative's acronym, may represent our aspirational goal for how diagnoses may be defined in the future, that this was in the distant future, and that for the present, the clinical diagnoses that have been used and continue to be refined through the iterative DSM process are the gold standard in what needs to be used. Absent these, which is basically the same set of diagnoses that are reflected in the ICD-10, there would be no way for consistency in communication and treatment to occur across populations and within the healthcare community. So to equate the thesis of the report from the British Psychological Society with the RDOCS initiative of the NIMH seems to me quite a stretch and really completely implausible. Now, why would such a report in a widely respected and read publication like the New York Times occur? What other medical specialty would be asked to endure a anthropologist opining on the scientific validity of its diagnoses? None other than psychiatry. Psychiatry has the dubious distinction of being the only medical specialty with an anti-movement. There's an anti-psychiatry movement, but you've never heard of any anti-cardiology movement, any anti-dermatology movement, any anti-orthopedics movement. So what would give an anthropologist license to comment on something which is so disciplined, bound, and evidence and scientifically anchored? I can't imagine how the New York Times editors would think that providing a platform to this would be useful. I mean, maybe they want to be edgy, they want to be provocative, and they think this is going to be somewhat controversial and attract readers, and it may be interesting reading. But frankly, I think it's irresponsible. Now, the author, who's a talented writer and obviously a smart and knowledgeable anthropologist, is written widely for the lay public as well as for the academic community in her area. And she's written 4 books. The areas that she writes on have to do with religion and God, witches, and psychiatry. So the equating of psychiatry with these other topics suggests you know, how she's thinking about psychiatry, not as a hard science, but as something which is either a philosophical slash sort of religious discipline, or has a supernatural or religious dimension, or is in the realm of the supernatural. Among her publications are things like Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God, Case Studies in Culture and Schizophrenia, Other Minds, Essays on the Way Mind Understanding Affects Mental Experience, Of Two Minds, The Growing Disorder in American Psychiatry, Persuasions of the Witchcraft, Ritual Magic in Modern Culture. You know, this harkens back to the days when psychiatry had only fanciful theories about the mind, what caused mental illness in people, and also, unfortunately, tried to implement ineffective or at times, you know, harmful and even barbaric treatments. Thankfully, we're well past that, where we now have scientifically developed and proven efficacious treatments that are safe and are changing and, in many cases, saving lives. But such articles really are anachronistic and a throwback to these earlier days of ignorance, fear, and perpetuate stigma. So why would the New York Times do this? It's really disturbing that we still live in an age where the stigma of mental illness and the lack of sort of interest in trying to present medical science as it, you know, deserves to be and needs to be for an informed public, is still sort of preyed upon by this kind of journalistic opportunism. I think that Dr. Lerman needs to be more thoughtful. Debate is to be encouraged, but this is not debate. This is a non-peer-reviewed opinion which is wholly uninformed and misguided, and is it, you know, useless and confusing at best and destructive at worst. And I don't see very many hard, scientifically grounded articles about psychiatry, whether it's in terms of mental health policy and services or in terms of new findings that are leading to better understanding and treatments in mental illness occurring in the times. More often it's the violence that occurs with mass killings or other sensationalistic stories. So at the very least I would like to see a more balanced editorial approach. Finally, when I read the article, disappointed and annoyed as I was, I tried to write a serious, responsible, and constructive letter to the editor, which I submitted within 24 hours. 72 hours have elapsed since the article's publication. I haven't heard from the Times of their interest in publishing the article, so I'm assuming they won't publish it. The name that I published under was my own. My credential was the chairman of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, one of the leading departments of psychiatry in the country, past president of the APA, and as an author of the forthcoming book for the lay public called Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. So, assuming my letter was not completely uninformed or incoherent, I would think that there would have been reason to accept it, given, you know, my credentials and my making a reasonable point. Let's see if they take it. But if they don't, that adds further to my dismay over what I consider to be journalistically irresponsible behavior by this once respected newspaper. So, thank you for your attention. This is Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman, Columbia University, speaking to you today for Medscape.